Let me die. Let me die.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 83. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of movies from the very early 1960s, a couple of horror films, which don't treat women very nicely at all. The first one is a 1962 American International Pictures release, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, starring Jason Evers, Virginia Leith and Eddie Carmel. And then we move back to 1960 for a movie that I saw when I was a kid, a very young kid, and it scared me the hell at the time. And it is The Hypnotic Eyes, starring Jacques Bergerac, Alice and Alison Hayes. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way. I'll put my tongue back in my mouth and we'll get on with the podcast. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white, or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Okay, how's everybody doing? The weather's cooling off here, which pisses me off no end. What I need is a house that slowly migrates north as the weather gets colder. Somebody arrange that for me, because it'll be really good if you could. I don't like the winter, as we all know, and it's heading toward that, unfortunately. The good side, have a couple of weeks off in early April. Sally and I are going up to Sydney. We're going to visit family and hit a few of the places we like up there in the old hometown. And it should be fine. It'll be refreshing and get the batteries recharged for the rest of the year. And I'm very much looking forward to it. The other thing I should mention too is it's coming up on my birthday in the middle of April. And that's the time at which the Patreon subscribers to the podcast get put in the draw to get a box full of cool stuff. Now, Grant Watson, the person who won it last year, ended up with a whole bunch of groovy stuff, which I handed to him at a science fiction convention in the middle of the year. And we went through the box and we podcasted live about what was in the box. There were movies, there were movie-related things. So it's worth getting in now if you can, because I'm going to have the raffle done based on the people who subscribe to the podcast via Patreon on the 17th of April, which happens to be my birthday. In fact, I'll probably be podcasting on my birthday because it's a Sunday. I usually do it on a Sunday. So that's upcoming, and that's all a bit groovy. I should talk about the things that I've watched. Now, this is going to be something fraught with danger. And the reason is that I did see Star Wars The Force Awakens, but I'm going to leave that aside for a moment and talk about the other things I've watched, and I'll come back to that, I promise. So, what have I watched? I saw a kind of little fantasy horror, a kind of sort of film on Netflix called He Never Dies, starring Henry Rollins as an immortal guy who's gets involved with some shenanigans and kicks up a fuss. It's a low budget movie, and Rollins, being a limited actor but a very kind of charismatic presence, I've seen him live on stage. He did some spoken word mixed in with some very loud and unpleasant music a number of years ago, and I did see him. And I've got a lot of time for Henry Rollins, even though he's a curmudgeonly sort of character. And the movie kind of works well. It's a bit of fun. I may rewatch it because I watched it when I was quite tired, and I do want to see it again just to kind of go through it. But He Never Died is worth checking out if you're in the mood for that sort of thing. The other thing, there's amongst other things I saw, was Pee-wee's Big Holiday, the 2016 Netflix Pee-wee Herman movie starring Paul Reubens. Now, Paul Reubens is 62 years old and playing Pee-wee Herman, so you've got to make certain allowances for that. But it's an okay Pee-wee movie. It's kind of halfway between, say, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Big Top Pee-wee. It kind of works. It's got the same kind of visual style that Pee-wee's Big Adventure had, and it's a bit of fun. Not meant to be taken seriously in any way, and not meant to be perhaps overanalyzed. But I did enjoy watching that. It was something new, a new Pee-wee thing, and in that I kind of enjoyed it. I did see a very bad comedy from the mid-1960s, which stars Maury Amsterdam, Rose Marie, Richard Deacon, all of whom were in the Dick Van Dyke Show. And it's called Don't Worry, We'll Think of a Title. Kind of very, very low budget, set, you know, in two or three sets. Lots of old vaudeville shtick kind of jokes. Nothing kind of out of the ordinary. And it's just like wall-to-wall vaudeville shtick, black and white. It's got a couple of surrealistic gags in it, which is kind of fun. But, it's kind of like, why did they do this kind of filmmaking, which it was kind of interesting in that, and it's a kind of artifact of its time. These people were well known for being on a very, very successful television show, and so they probably got their bait back on the movie ultimately. I did see a movie called Timeline from 2003, which has Paul Walker in it, Billy Connolly, and a bunch of other character actors. It's about a bunch of scientists and archaeologists who go back in time through a wormhole to medieval France during a large battle. And it's got some interesting character actors in it, like Michael Sheen's in it, for instance. And, it's kind of okay. Grant Watson mentioned it on his Angriest blog, The Angriest, and I thought I'd rewatch it, and it wasn't bad. Directed by Richard Donner. But, it's watchable. It's not bad, but it's watchable. And I kind of enjoyed revisiting that. It wasn't as bad as I'd remembered it being. Now, speaking of things that are bad, I did see Bruce versus Clark, Batman versus Superman, The Dawn of Justice. And it's bad. I'll be honest with you, it is bad. And I'll tell you why it's bad. It's cliched. It's got that horrible... I really have a problem with Zack Snyder's style of things, where everything seems to take place on a cloudy late afternoon. There's no sunny days. The colour palette is skewed to the grey. It's there's no tone to it. And it's, you know, he's got a visual style of his own. And yeah, all respect to him for that. But it's not a visual style that's right for this kind of a product. There's a bit of miscasting as well. Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor is a mistake. I think he makes some bad acting choices in there. I won't go into it too much because I may talk about it in a future podcast. I was thinking of getting Luke and Gabby back because Luke's a big DC fan. I want to get his take on Batman versus Superman, but I saw it in a kind of mostly empty cinema at 9:30 a.m. on Good Friday. And I'm going to go into a rant here for a moment. Half an hour of advertising in a cinema while you're waiting to watch a movie is way too much. End of rant. But I saw that. I think that it's a crazy misstep by DC. There hasn't been a movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that's quite as bad as this. And so DC has a lot of catching up to do if they're going to keep investing in this kind of storytelling in the future. But I saw that. And I saw a really weird movie from the mid-1960s, directed by J. Lee Thompson. It's in black and white, and it stars Deborah Carr, David Niven, David Hemmings is in it as well, Donald Pleasance, and Sharon Tate, and it's called Eye of the Devil. It's kind of like a precursor to The Wicker Man. David Niven plays a French aristocrat, which is a stretch, who has to go back to his ancestral estate from Paris because they have grapevines, the grape vintners in this village. and the crops failing. And it's got to do with pagan devil worship and all sorts of things. And Deborah Carr kind of rehashes a little bit of the innocence in it. It's really not very good at all. But if you're a kind of completist on these sort of things and you'll go out of your way to see that kind of stuff, then Eye of the Devil might work for you. I think some of the photography is very kind of cloudy and grainy where it doesn't need to be. I don't think it's a problem with the print. I think it's a problem with the original filming of the thing. And they actually recast it late in the piece. They'd filmed about 75% of the movie with Kim Novak, and then she had a disagreement with the director. And so they had to go back and refilm everything with Deborah Carr in the same role. So it's one of those movies that probably suffered for that kind of kerfuffle about it. It was on TCM, so I watched it, and yeah, I probably won't watch it again. Which brings us back to Star Wars The Force Awakens. Now, I appreciate that Star Wars is something that a great number of people love. I don't understand it, but I accept that it occurs. This movie doesn't give them anything new. It gives them a rehashing of something old. It doesn't take chances. It plays it so corporately safe that it's a disappointment to a number of people. Yes, a lot of people enjoy the fan squeak, but I've talked to a few kind of dyed-in-the-wool, deeply rooted Star Wars fans, and I mean deeply rooted in an ambiguous way, of course. And at least one of them, who surprised me a little bit, said that it was kind of ordinary. It doesn't do anything new. It does the same thing it did before. J.J. Abrams, being the pasticheur he is, copied a lot of the first Star Wars movie in this movie and just kind of tweaked and updated the special effects and things. It has a lot of the same beats as the original Star Wars movie. It has a lot of the same situations. It has characters that act as substitute for the characters in that first movie. Now, Sally is an enormous fan of Harrison Ford. And this is a spoiler, so jump ahead a minute if you don't want to hear it. When Han Solo gets killed by the emo Vader, who is his son, it's supposed to be an enormously emotionally impacting scene. Sally just didn't care. Now, she's invested in Harrison Ford more than a lot of other people, but there was the way it was framed, the shots were framed, the way it was put together, the kind of obviousness with which it occurred pissed her off. And when she isn't invested in a character that she likes a lot, played by an actor she likes a lot, dying, there's something deeply and seriously wrong with it. Yes, it made a shit ton of money, and yes, a number of people had their fan squeak and their nostalgia for childhood and all that kind of thing, but I think that it's probably a very good object lesson in what not to do when you're resurrecting a franchise. Don't keep doing the same thing. Take a chance, take a risk. Have some faith in your own talent. Have some faith in the talent of the people you're working with. And try something new. Having said that, Oscar Isaac was very good, playing Poe Dameron. And Daisy Ridley is good, playing Rey. John Boyega doesn't get a lot to do. I don't think his character was deeply written enough. But I like John Boyega, and I think that he's got a great career in his future. But, it's one of those things where the fan service, or the perception that you have to do fan service in a movie of this kind, worked against it being a good film. And that's kind of a pity, and it's an object lesson for a lot of people working on franchise products. And of course, most of the money in Hollywood these days is going towards franchise products. Playing it safe and playing it kind of, there's a bit of talk around about it being respectful of the original movie. Don't be respectful of original movies. If you're going to do a sequel, show people something they haven't seen, take them to a place they haven't been, and you will extend the franchise. Do something new, do something audacious, do something interesting, but don't do the same thing again. It's Star Wars as a franchise seems to have a curse to it. Now, I don't believe in curses, but I'm going to throw this out there anyway. It really isn't ever going to be as good as the first time you might have seen the first movie when you were a child. You need to kind of accept that. And I think that the people making these movies have to accept that and move outwards. And, or even just leave it alone. Don't do it. Just let it die. Let the franchise die. Let it move on. One of the things with sequels is do something new. If you're going to put a movie in the same universe, do something different. Don't do the same stuff because you're being dishonest and you're not giving yourself enough credit for the skills and imagination and applied talent that you have. So that's as far as I can get on that kind of thing. But anyway, we're going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of these two movies, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, starring Jason Evers, Virginia Leith, and Eddie Carmel.
You've lost the urge to experiment.
Oh, every time you touch me, I go out of my mind.
Kept alive by experimental science, by a man whose abnormal passions inspired him to try the impossible.
I brought her back. She'll live and I'll get her another body.
Yes, and what of her soul? How can you make of her an experiment of horror?
His mad ambitions and desires threaten every woman possessing an attractive body. Girls whose measurements make them beauty contest participants. Professional figure models such as this. All are prey to his distorted desires.
What's locked behind that door?
Horror. No normal mind can imagine. Something even more terrible than you.
Horror has its ultimate. And I'm that.
Behind that door is the sum total of Dr. Cortner's mistakes.
He intends to kill somebody. To rob them of their body. We've got to stop him.
Okay, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, 1962 American science fiction / horror film directed by Joseph Green. It's one of the only three projects he ever directed. He made it in his own studios in Tarrytown, New York. Yeah, it's a sick and twisted movie, this one. You'll love it. By the way, it is also in the public domain, so if you find a copy of it, say, on archive.org, and there's a reasonable print of it there, go for it. Definitely download it and enjoy it, because you're allowed to. Nobody's going to give you any shit about it. Not that anybody ever does, but if you want a conscience-free viewing of this film, you can have it by downloading it from pretty much anywhere. It stars Virginia Leith, an actress who was in a number of films in the 1950s, including a film I should do for my Paleo Cinema podcast, Violent Saturday, which has a kick-ass cast. It's got Victor Mature, Lee Marvin, Richard Egan, Stephen McNally, and Sylvia Sidney in it, amongst others. I'm really going to have to add that movie to the list, because I do want to do it. A really good, solid action film, and Virginia Leith was a part of that. She also starred in another movie that I have a great fondness for, which is A Kiss Before Dying, the original version, not the one with Matt Dillon in it. She did episodic TV as well. She had a hiatus after making The Brain That Wouldn't Die in 1962, and then turned up in the 1977 for episodes of Beretta and Starsky and Hutch. And there's not much else since then, but she did have a something of a career in the 1950s. Dated Marlon Brando at one stage as well, which is kind of interesting. And when web pages say dated, it's kind of code for something a little more than dated. And I'll talk about that more when I talk about The Hypnotic Eye, because there's a little bit of that kind of shenanigans involved with the actors in The Hypnotic Eye as well. But yeah, this movie basically it has Jason Evers, who at the time was calling himself Herb Evers because his original first name was Herbert. He plays Dr. Bill Cortner, a very talented but very unethical surgeon, whose father is the head of the medical facility where he works. His son's experimenting with transplants and is stealing body parts to experiment with transplants, which is always a sign that maybe the surgeon involved needs a checkup from the neck up. So Cortner does these experiments in a country house that his family owns, where he has an assistant called Kurt, played by Leslie Daniels, who has an arm that was transplanted onto him by Cortner, and it hasn't quite come right. He's got a kind of twisted and malformed arm because of that. So Cortner, with his fiancée, Jen Compton, played by Virginia Leith, drive up there because there's an emergency. One of the experiments is breaking out of the room they keep him locked in. So Cortner drives like a maniac in one of those enormous yank tank 1950s cars that you only ever see in Cuba these days, and crashes. Now, as a part of that crash, his girlfriend, fiance, Jan's head is severed. So being the man he is, he takes the head to the lab and keeps it alive. Now, this is where we get the term Jan in a pan, because Jan's head's kept alive in a pan full of liquid with a head brace on and bandaging around her head. And Cortner, being totally fucking insane, decides that what he needs to do is find his fiance a new body, transplant her head onto that new body, and live happily ever after. Now, things don't turn out like that, and that's not too much of a surprise, because apart from anything else, when Jan wakes up, she doesn't want to be alive. She's a head in a pan, basically, and really, you know, not the kind of life she'd planned to lead in her 1950s fantasy of happy families, which, you know, if you're going to have that kind of a scenario, which, you know, all strength to her for that. But if you're going to have that sort of scenario, the last thing you do is have a fiance who's a fucking insane mad scientist. Not what you should be doing. But Jan's there and she talks to Kurt, and she also talks to the monster in the cupboard, who's played by an interesting guy called Eddie Carmel, who was actually photographed by Diane Arbus. He was known as the Jewish Giant. He was an enormously tall, enormously large guy, and for most of the film always sees his hand reaching out of a little hatch in the door. And the guy had an enormous hand. It's the size of other people's heads, and having that enormous hand reach out and grab various actors during the film is quite a striking and interesting little piece. But the sick and twisted part is Cortner leaves his girlfriend in the pan in the lab, not too careful about her psychological well-being. He ignores the fact that she wants to die and is asking him to turn off the life support. And he goes cruising the streets of the town and going to strip clubs and places where photographic models are photographed in skimpy clothing. So he can essentially supermarket shop for the body he wants Jan's head to be on. Now, leaving aside the fact that medical ethics don't let you do that, the fact that what he's doing basically is having deep and intense sexual fantasies about having Jan's head on a pin-up model's body. And Virginia Leith, you know, is very attractive. It was a very attractive actress at that time. And, there's some deep and twisted sexuality about this Cortner guy. And Jason Evers, not a crazily nuanced actor. Did a lot of episodic TV, for instance, and was kind of good in stolid male kind of authority figure roles. Kind of plays up to that kind of lustful craziness that's essential for this role. This is, in some ways, one of the most fucked up movies sexually, and as far as sexual politics between the genders are concerned, you could ever hope to see. It's deeply, deeply disturbing. And there's actually the version I've got's on a 4-disc with a bunch of other movies, including Reptilicus. And they also have an additional scene from The Brain That Wouldn't Die, which is done for the European market. If you know what that is, you know that it means they kind of have some racier inserts put in. And in this particular one, they go, it's set in the photographic models studio, where the figure model Doris, played by Adele Lamont, is seen topless. It's just to keep the European market happy. These movies, of course, were sold to the European market. And the titillation, of course, was ramped up because of that. Now, the movie, of course, has a cult reputation. It gets referenced a number of times. There was a musical version in 2009 called The Brain That Wouldn't Die, a new musical, which showed at San Antonio in Texas, which wouldn't be bad to see that. It'd be a lot of fun. There was a stage musical production, there's a musical stage production apart from that called The Brain That Wouldn't Die in 3D, which was done in the New York Musical Theatre Festival in 2011. And there's also another musical theatre production in 2015 in Olympia, Washington, called The Head, exclamation mark, The Wouldn't Die. So that was written by a collective called the Tau Collective and the ensemble cast. So basically they improvised around it. Now, when a movie has a kind of influence over that kind of time, and the fact that it's in the public domain, of course, makes it much more accessible as well, which is kind of cool. People can get hold of it, and people can also adapt it as they like because nobody owns the rights. Then when it does have this kind of, you know, really messed up plot and with a really messed up mad scientist character, you know that the campy musical versions are going to spring out of the woodwork. And this one's in the period of 5 years, 6 years, had three musical adaptations of it, is kind of a credit to the kind of camp cult craziness of The Brain That Wouldn't Die. And, you know, that's kind of in some ways a recognition that this movie has, in some twisted and fucked up way, some merit. And there is that argument too, because even though Virginia Lee didn't like making the film, and in fact didn't go back to post-sync the audio, and they had to get somebody else from the movie to do parts of her dialogue in the redubbing of the audio, and even in spite of that, she is quite good in the role. I mean, she is a beautiful woman. She's very vivacious. And in playing this character, which, you know, you don't really get that at Stella Adler or the Actors Studio. It doesn't give you a lot to work with when you're trying to play a disembodied head with suicidal tendencies. I think she does quite well in it, and she is quite poignant as the character. And the fact that it can be read as a parable for female helplessness in 1950s, 1960s American society. You can't get more helpless than being a disembodied head in a pan full of liquid. And, you know, that being trapped, in a sense, by your fiancé in what is essentially an abusive relationship. There are parallels there as well, which make it play differently now than it might have in the past. This is kind of, in some way, a story about the ultimate abused woman in a relationship. And in common with The Hypnotic Eye, it does have that theme about it, which can be seen as a feminist theme, right up to and including the fact that Jan eventually takes control in some sense. She talks to the monster in the other room, and she talks to Kurt, and she uses not her charm and female wiles or anything like that, but she uses empathy and logic to get both of them to understand that this thing that has happened to her is wrong, and that she has the right to determine her own life or the end of her own life. And that's kind of a very powerful thing as well. The monster eventually, of course, breaks out and goes berserk and sets the lab on fire. And there's the movie ends with the maniacal laughter of Jan, which is kind of a scary way to end the film. And the more I think about it, the more that's the only possible ending you could have in this kind of a film, where she, I mean, I suppose you could kind of go with a Stuart Gordon kind of ending, where she ends up with her head transplanted onto her fiancé's body and starts living as a man. That'd be one way to end the film, which kind of, you know, knocks, plays with those gender roles in a very 21st century way. And why not, indeed, if you're going to remake that film, that may be one of the alternate ways of ending it rather than just having the lab burns down kind of ending. And if you want to remake the film, of course you can, because it is in the public domain. But I like the film for a number of reasons. First off, I like the audacity of how fucked up the plot is. I'm not too fond of the extended sequences with scantily clad beauty contestants and photographic models and stuff like that. It gets a little dull after a while, and it doesn't move the plot forward. Yes, we understand that Bill Cortner is out there shopping for a new body for his fiancée, but that, in order to fill out the running time that's necessary for this kind of a film, and it does, there's a 70-minute version and an 82-minute version of this film, so it shows you that it's not particularly long, and the story isn't the kind of story that can carry a long film anyway. But having said that, it's got a campiness about it that does mean that those musicals that they made in the 21st century based on this particular movie kind of work. And while thinking about it as well, there's nothing to say that you couldn't gender role reverse a remake of this movie and have a female scientist who has a disembodied head of her male fiancé, or even her female fiancé. You can make the scientist a female and kind of, you know, play with the idea of that helplessness and that lack of self-sovereignty that is an essential part of this movie. There's a number of ways you could play this, and it would be kind of interesting were someone to do those kind of, you know, twisting and turning of the particular story in order to extend and enlarge the themes that are a part of it. Now, right at the start of the podcast, I played a bit of Jan, the character, asking to die for a particular reason. And I think one of, you know, even though I appreciate the campiness of the movie and I kind of understand that it's an artifact of its time and all of that kind of thing, I was quite discomforted by just how horrible and sad her plight was as well. Maybe it's part of my maturation as a human being, where I understand that even though this movie is an entertainment, there's some serious themes in it. I was quite discomforted at times by that. And that kind of makes it a more interesting film in some ways than if I was just kind of yucking it up and knocking back the popcorn and enjoying it just as an AIP 1962 release. But this movie's got more to it than that. And it's probably why I found it so interesting and thought it was worthwhile to do on the podcast. As I said, it is in the public domain and you can get it from archive.org is where I got the bit where I ripped the audio from. It's not a big download. It's on MP4 format, so you might as well watch it and see. It's really, I keep coming back to that Bill Cortner character and how focused on his own career and focused on his own achievements that character is. It really is a fucked up piece of cinema, and it only cost $62,000 to make as well. So it's low budget filmmaking in a certain genre niche. It's a driving kind of movie. It's designed to fulfill the need of the market in that sense, but also it's got a lot more to it than that, even if the writers didn't necessarily, in a conscious level, understand that in 1962 when the film was made. But again, it plays differently in the 21st century, which is kind of cool. Movies that play the same now as they did when they were first made are a bit boring in a sense. And I don't think that when you've got these kind of themes, they do that. I mean, you can revisit things like, say, The Rock Hudson, Doris Day, sex comedies, in inverted commas, of the 1950s and 1960s, and they play very differently now because of our awareness of Rock Hudson's closeted status and the kind of repression of sexuality that was a part of that kind of cinema at the time. These movies do, yeah, they hit the screen differently and hit our minds differently after they hit the screen than they did at the time they were made. And I'm kind of cool with that, and I find it intriguing that you can revisit and reinterpret films based on changes in the culture. But anyway, I'm going to take a break. Now, when I get back, we're going to talk about another fucked up movie about people being nasty to women. And that is the 1960 movie made by Allied artists, The Hypnotic Eye, starring Jacques Bergerac, Alison Hayes, Mary Anders, Eric Big Daddy Nord, Ferdinand de Mera, who I'll talk about more, and Lawrence Lipton as King of the Beatniks.
I have just written a poem. Let me hear that beat, man. That's the beatest beat. Confessions of a Movie Addict, or The Holy Barbarian Blues. I was a teenage movie monster. I cut my teeth on Clara Bow. I dug Rudolph Valentino. I was hooked on all the vampire movie queens. I rode with a posse and cut them off at the pass. I was thrilled by the Thing from outer space. Man, I was a mess. Then I was turned on by Shakespeare, Plato, Aristotle, Edgar Guest. I saw Charlie's Aunt in the original uncut version. Crazy, man, crazy. One day I wandered drunk, dazed, wild-eyed, into an art movie house. You know, loose marks with subtitles. Now I'm cool, man, cool. I've kicked the movie habit. I'm off to make the interstellar scene. Aloha, dos vidanio, au revoir, goodbye, later, man, later.
That's a weird little insert in The Hypnotic Eye. It's a couple of the characters end up in a nightclub, a beatnik nightclub, which has got nothing to do with any of the rest of the story. And that little narration, that little kind of poem, comes up. It was done by a guy called Lawrence Lipton. Now, the reason I'm putting that at the start of talking about The Hypnotic Eye is one of those things that I find weird linkages between stuff when I research these movies. And Lawrence Lipton is the father of James Lipton, who does Inside the Actor's Studio. And I found that very, very weird. He's one of the two connections that I found when I was researching The Hypnotic Eye that make it very interesting. And I'll talk about the second one just a little bit later. Now, The Hypnotic Eye is a pretty simple story. I'll read you the Wikipedia précis on it. Mysterious hypnotist Desmond, Jacques Bergerac, comes to a town to present his act just as a series of women gruesomely disfigure themselves, apparently while in trances. A local doctor and a detective try to find the reason, and that's pretty much it. It stars Jacques Bergerac, who for a time was married to Ginger Rogers of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers fame, and then at the time this film was made was married to Dorothy Malone, who won a Best Supporting Actress Oscar for Written on the Wind, the Douglas Sirk film in 1956. Jacques Bergerac, I find him interesting in this film, not for reasons that you might understand. He's got a very thick French accent, and he's supposed to play this charismatic and mesmeric hypnotist, and he's not very good at it. But on the other hand, it is an Allied artist picture with a budget of $365,000, so we've got to make allowances for that. Now, the other people in the movie are Alison Hayes playing Justine, who is the assistant to Desmond, the hypnotist, who also does a levitation magic trick, which is a little bit odd because they're two separate things. Hypnotism works because of, hypnotism, basically. And the levitation trick is done with a mechanism concealed in either the floor or behind the curtain. So it's a little bit odd that they conflate those two things into one act for this guy. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. The thing that I remember most from my childhood viewing of The Hypnotic Eye, it was on one of those late night TV horror movie things that were usually on a Saturday night. It might have even been Deadly Earnest Awful Movies. There's a scene right at the start which comes before the titles where a beautiful woman in lingerie walks into her kitchen, starts rubbing what she thinks is shampoo into her hair and leaning over what we at first think is a sink. But then she turns the knob and it's actually a gas stove. And then there's this great cutscene with some kind of ropey and cute photographic effects where she sits, she kind of raises her head and her hair and her head are on fire. It's the special effects don't really work for us in the 21st century context, but for the time they were quite shocking, and I found it quite disturbing as a child to see that. Then they cut to the ambulance taking her to hospital, and the titles come up, and then we meet Joe Patridge as Dave Kennedy, the cop, and Guy Prescott as Philip Hecht, the doctor, both of whom have absolutely zero career. They are not in any way interesting characters, and as actors, they're not very good. In fact, their careers really went nowhere.
11 women. Attractive, some even beautiful. Each one of them mutilated herself in some crazy way. I mean, they can't all be accidents.
What else?
I don't know. One of them stuck her face into the blades of an electric fan. Said she thought it was a vibrator. Another one slashed her face with a straight razor. She thought the razor was a lipstick brush. How do you explain it?
I don't. That's your job.
Now, one of the things we do see, though, is we meet a hospital doctor played by a guy called Fred DeMera. Now, Fred DeMera is such an interesting human being that they made a movie starring Tony Curtis based on his life. Now, Fred DeMera looks about as much like a young Tony Curtis as I do. He's kind of big and flabby and has a Boston accent and looks more like the late actor Glenn Shattuck than he does Tony Curtis. So he has this little bit as a hospital doctor where he explains the injuries that one of the women has. It's actually a friend of Sergeant Dave Kennedy's called Dirty Wilson, played by Mary Anders. Fred DeMera. Now, I probably should explain about him. Fred DeMera, whose real name is Ferdinand Waldo DeMera. He died in 1982. He was known as the Great Imposter. Remember Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me As You Can, where he played Frank Abagnale? Same thing, but much earlier on. In the 1950s, Fred DeMera pretended to be a ship's doctor, a civil engineer, a sheriff's deputy, an assistant prison warden, a doctor of applied psychology, a hospital orderly, a lawyer, a childcare expert, a Benedictine monk, a Trappist monk, an editor, a cancer researcher, and a teacher. And he had an extraordinary IQ, and he could cram and learn massive amounts of information all at once. But he didn't kind of have the kind of mind and the patience to go through the process of becoming any of these things in a genuine way. Now, I'm just reading a little bit off Wikipedia about him, which is fascinating stuff. He had come to two beliefs. One is that any organization, there's always a lot of loose, unused power lying around about which can be picked up without alienating anyone. A second rule, if you want power and want to expand it, never encroach on anyone else's domain. Open up new ones. So DeMera was all about expanding into power vacuum. He pretended to be something and he built himself a power base in a particular industry. He actually founded a college as well when he was impersonating a Christian brother. That college now became Walsh University. He did it under the church and he kind of got the college started, but he was never actually a priest. He was never part of the Catholic hierarchy. And because in those days paperwork could be easily faked and there weren't the electronic trails we have now, DeMera actually managed to work his scams just because he wanted to do this kinds of work. He wasn't trying to make particular large amounts of money out of it apart from the wages involved. He kind of, you know, he just kind of went in and did the things that interested him. He was a weird character. Died of complications from diabetes in the 1980s. But, yeah, he actually turned up in this movie as a very small part, basically, to give the movie some hook for any kind of promotion they wanted to do for the film. So he turns up there, and I didn't actually know this until I looked into the movie after seeing it, but I did notice that the Doctor was an unusual type to play a Doctor. In a movie, he was portly, he had a thick Bostonian accent, and it didn't quite seem the right kind of guy. But sure enough, he was the great imposter, and a small piece of movie history in himself. But to get back to the hypnotic eye, it's a really kind of, it's one of those movies where there's a kind of misogynistic aspect to the horror. This hypnotist, Desmond, is, we think at the start of the film at least, and I'm not going to do spoilers on who the actual criminal is, we think he's hypnotizing women during his stage show to then go off and mutilate themselves for whatever reason, for his own gratification, in a sense. He flirts with them, he takes some of them out to dinner, he does all those kind of romantic things that you'd expect from a handsome Frenchman to do. But they go home and in various ways mutilate themselves. Dodie, who for some reason has strong sulfuric acid lying around the house, washes her face in sulfuric acid, not realizing that it's sulfuric acid because of the hypnotic trance she's in. Another woman slashed her face in various ways. Another woman plucked out her eyes. There are all these kind of gruesome bits and pieces that are part of this film. Now, the special effects and the makeup effects are pretty rudimentary. They tend to be the kind of, you know, latex rubber and toilet paper rolled up kind of special effects, those ropey 1950s ones, which seemed effective at the time but don't actually resemble real world kind of disfigurement and wounds. But I remember at the time, being a small and impressionable child, that these things, you know, I took them at face value, and I accepted the fact that there were these horribly disfigured women who, because of this evil French hypnotist, were basically self-harming in a very graphic and lurid kind of way. And of course, you know, this is the kind of thing that people were drawn to with these kind of drive-in movies. They were horrified by them, but they were drawn to them as well. This wasn't a big budget, big studio film. This wasn't South Pacific or The Greatest Story Ever Told or Ben-Hur or Spartacus or anything like that. This was kind of grassroots, in a weird sense, working class cinema. It was the kind of movies that people saw in drive-ins and late night on TV, of course, in the 1960s. They were cheap for television stations to buy in massive amounts and show them on late at night to fill the time and to get a few advertising dollars and that kind of thing. But they were never expected to be any good at all. But they are memorable. And seeing these kind of films at an early age does kind of, I'm not going to say scar you, but it does give you a nostalgia and appreciation for this kind of schlock. And that's indeed what it is. I mean, now I'm going to do a spoiler here for the movie, but relax, the movie's 55 years old. A spoiler is not entirely unjustified after so many years. The actual villain is the assistant, Justine, played by Alison A. Hayes, who was the 50-foot woman in the movie, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, which if you haven't seen, you really should. It's a memorable little piece of schlock cinema as well. She made that 2 years before this film in 1958. She was also in another movie that I remember from my childhood that scared the fuck out of me as well. A movie called Zombies of Muratau, which was made in 1957. And it's a kind of no-budget zombie movie. It had kind of slow, shambling zombies in the old way that these things were. And the movies that Alison Hayes made were the kind of B pictures. She was in Sign of the Pagan, which I think, and I'm going to click on this, if you hear a click, that's me clicking on it, which I think had Jeff Chandler in it. I should really do some Jeff Chandler movies for the podcast. Yep, Jeff Chandler playing Attila the Hun, and Jack Palance in it as well. So there's a couple of good reasons to see that movie and talk about it on one of the podcasts. So she was in Zombies of Morata, The Undead, Hong Kong Confidential, Pier 5 Havana, The Crawling Hand in 1963, and a career doppelt out in the late 1960s for a very strange and quite tragic reason. Her health started to suffer and she ended up having to walk with a cane, and she had some kind of mysterious illness. And eventually she found out that the calcium supplement she was taking contained large amounts of lead, and there was no FDA control of these things at the time in any meaningful way. Eventually she died of the ailments related to that. But one of the things she did before she died was she took this to the government, she took it to the FDA, she told her story, she explained it very well. She kind of did the politicking and the advocating for more quality testing and control on mineral supplements that people took. And she received a letter just after she died saying that the FDA had approved all of the things she wanted and that they would be following the processes we now know for mineral and vitamin supplements. A lot of those kind of things that the FDA in America has is because of the advocacy work while she was dying of Alison Hayes, who people knew as a B-movie scream queen actress in the 1950s. So we should give proper good on you to Alison Hayes for that. She had a horrible experience later in her life, not through any fault of her own, and her main focus was to stop this from happening to other people, so she gets a lot of credit for that. Now, the main female character in the movie is actually Marcia Henderson, playing Marcia Blaine. Now, Marcia Henderson, again, another striking and good-looking actress, and I'll explain later why Alison Hayes' Justine character is the main villain. Marcia Henderson is mostly known because she was one of... I just knocked the microphone off my head. She was one of the dates that Frank Sinatra had at home, so he could call up Marcia Henderson whenever he was feeling lonely and a little bit kind of restless, and she'd pop over. Now, she was also a girlfriend of Bing Crosby, who was, of course, married at the time. So she was one of those kind of minor actresses who was unfortunately known more for who she dated than anything she did. And the 1950s in Hollywood was replete with those kind of actors. Unfortunately, it's a kind of male entitlement business writ large again. Her career as well, and this movie's tragic for these reasons, and it's quite unfair to the actors. She got rheumatoid arthritis in the early 1960s, and her career ended because of that, and she ended up dying prematurely in Yakima, Washington, of things related to rheumatoid arthritis. She ended up developing lupus and died of that. So this movie is full of women who, reasonable actresses, I mean, they weren't kind of Sarah Bernhardt or Cate Blanchett, but they were attractive and they did the roles asked of them, and they kind of, you know, did the dialogue and were kind of jobbing actresses, to use the term that people like me using about various actors and actresses. They were, you know, kind of tradespeople in the industry, in a sense. And both of them had unfortunate ends to their lives. But in this movie, they're both beautiful and striking. And Alison Hayes' Justine, we have the bit at the end where we learn why Justine is mutilating all these women, where her beautiful face is actually a mask to hide her own disfigurement. And there's a great scene where she reveals this while standing up in the flies above a stage in a theatre. And I remembered that bit from my childhood as well, because it's pretty striking. This movie's kind of there for those kind of shock horror little bits and pieces, and it does a pretty good job of it. Now, the movie was directed by a director who was mostly known for his television work and didn't really do a lot of movies, a fellow by the name of George Blair. George Blair made a number of flicks. I'm just going to click in to take a look at it. A number of TV episodes in all of the things you'd expect somebody who was a director in the 1950s and 1960s to do TV episodes of. died in 1970. He did a number of The Adventures of Superman, Wanted Dead or Alive with Steve McQueen, Tales of the Texas Rangers, Casey Jones. He did a movie called Sabu and the Magic Ring. He was in the Highway Patrol, the Roy Rogers Show, and his last credit on IMDb as a director was an episode of The Littlest Hobo, which was about a TV series I remember from way back in the day, which was about pretty much a homeless dog, a homeless Alsatian dog that kind of wandered through the land like Kane in Kung Fu, helping people out and, you know, catching bad guys and helping little kids out of wells and doing all that kind of lassie stuff. Ran for two seasons between 1963 and 1965. And The Littlest Hobo was played by London the Dog, who has got his own IMDb page. And with three credits on it, one of which is The Littlest Hobo. But, yeah, so just to kind of wrap it up for The Hypnotic Eye, it's one of those kind of schlocky 1960s movies. I love the fact that they had them on television when I was a kid, because it gave me a background in kind of low budget driving sort of movies, and I've had a fondness for them ever since. Quality films, the little Dolce Vitas and all of those quality films, are something I came to late, but the kind of working class low budget, churned out by the dozen, shown on TV in packages. They packaged up these movies in a whole bunch of lots and sold the whole packet to TV studios in America and in Australia for a pittance, so they'd have some product to play when they weren't doing quiz shows and other shit like that that Australian television was replete with at various times. But I like The Hypnotic Eye. I think that even if it does have that kind of ugly, misogynistic, disfiguring beautiful women angle to it, it's again got that kind of subtext where Alison Hayes' character Justine is driven mad by the fact that she has her own disfigurement. And you can always go into the angle of it that this is about the beauty myth, and this is about women have to look beautiful, otherwise they're not worth anything in society. And in the 1950s and 1960s, that was probably the case. We also see some of the victims of Desmond in this film, and they've withdrawn from the world in various ways. And that, again, it's not exactly feminist, even though one of the writers of the movie, Jeeta Woodfield, who with her husband William Reed Woodfield wrote the script, there is that aspect as well where they show the effects after the disfigurement of these women, and some of it's pretty kind of raw. There's some very nice acting by women wrapped up in bandages in this film, and I think it's very sympathetic to them, even though for most of the time we follow the guys around, the doctor and the policeman who are investigating this thing. We do get Marsha Henderson's character Marsha getting on the front foot and offering herself up as bait to find out what Desmond is actually doing. And she, in a sense, goes undercover to reveal what the problem is and shows a lot of guts in doing so. She's really, even though ultimately she is hypnotized, she's willing to kind of put herself at peril to stop this happening to other people. And that's a kind of admirable trait, and it's a little more than the usual kind of, you know, screaming victim female stereotype that we get in these kind of films. And I think that because Jeeta Woodfield had a part of the script, I think that that aspect of it may have come into play, not necessarily as a feminist thing, but as a way of giving a somewhat better role to women. In fact, the best acting in this film is across the board the women. Jacques Bergerac's Desmond is pretty fucking ordinary, and Joe Patridge and Guy Prescott are, yeah, just kind of placeholders. It's not that the roles are underwritten. In fact, there's some quirkiness about them, and Guy Prescott's doctor gets a little bit better at that. But Joe Patridge is a wooden stiff when it comes to acting in this film, and really doesn't, his career didn't go anywhere, possibly because he just do a good job at it. He's the sort of guy who wasn't suited to being an actor. He looked good. He was tall and good looking, and athletic, but he just didn't have the ticker to be a decent actor. But The Hypnotic Eye is a lot of fun. If you can find a copy of it, definitely watch it. It's a bit hard to say you really like it because the themes in it are a bit icky at times, but it's very much of its time, and in that way it's from an historical point of view, it's interesting to see what horrified people and how very simple makeup effects, along with some solid acting by the female cast members, really put across this horror story in a very effective way for its time. But anyway, now I've said I was going to do some feedback because I have received feedback from various people. But I just, unfortunately, this is over the Easter weekend that I'm recording this. I just don't have time to put it in. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do an episode of Paleo Cinema this weekend. And I'm going to release it next weekend. That's going to have all the feedback for both of the podcasts on it. So please keep sending the feedback to cultguru@gmail.com or on the Facebook page. But the feedback will be coming through next time around. Anyway, I'm going to leave you, of course, as usual, with the credits in the style of movie credits from all of the people who support Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast through the Patreon campaign. And I've also, of course, got to add one more to the... there's one person who has kindly contributed but hasn't given me yet the particular credit that he wants. So, Mark, if you can get in touch with me, I'm more than happy to put your credit there, but I thank you separately for supporting the podcast. So here are the credits again, and anyway, take care of yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies, watch 1960s horror movies with misogynistic themes, but just keep watching movies and keep watching the skies, and I'll be back very soon with another podcast. Take care of yourselves, and I will catch you later. And by the way, I do know that the audio on the credits is a bit ropey, and I will be re-recording it next week. Take care. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In podcast done in the style of movie credits. Thank you very much to all of the people who've supported the Patreon campaign, and you can do that too by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, who is our director of monster effects, and you can find his stuff at CushingHorrors.com, and Eric as our set security head, and David Luce is our First Amendment counsel. So thank you very much to all of the people who have supported the podcast financially via the Patreon campaign.